This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back to the Daily Digest on The Bigger Picture with Tina Carmelia, Tisha Oik and Juliet Jacobs. The WHO has published the top 10 health threats facing the world in 2019. There are the usual suspects like non-communicable diseases, dengue and HIV, and then there's some curious ones.
Oh, curious. Well, anyway, before we get to those though, we asked you on Twitter, what do you think about anti-vaxxers? And 90% of you said that you think they cause more diseases, and very few of you said that you agree with them. So I suppose that's reassuring. But what does the anti-vax movement have to do with our story today, Tina?
So let's walk through the list in no particular order, but we will get to that in a little bit.
Yeah, so this came as no surprise, HIV. Although we've made a lot of progress against HIV in terms of getting people tested and providing those with HIV with antiretrovirals and, you know, access to pre-exposure prophylaxis, the epidemic continues to affect millions of people each year, with some 1 million dying of HIV and AIDS. This year, the WHO will work with countries to support the introduction of self-testing. Back in December 2018, the WHO and the International Labour Organization announced that they will support companies and organizations to offer HIV self-tests in the workplace. Wow, that's really progressive.
Indeed. And then there's non-communicable diseases such as diabetes, cancer and heart disease, which collectively are the world's biggest killers, responsible for 70% of deaths worldwide, or 41 million people, including 15 million people dying prematurely between the ages of 30 and 69. This trend is expected to continue this year as long as we don't address tobacco use, physical inactivity, unhealthy diet and poor mental health.
Next on the list is antimicrobial resistance. So there's an increase in the ability of pathogens to resist treatment to once effective drugs. And AMR, or antimicrobial resistance, is considered one of the biggest health challenges of our time. Routine surgeries, chemotherapies and infection management could become extremely risky because of this trend. Now, let's hear a short clip from a recent public health episode we did on health and living about antibiotic resistance. So here's Dr. Lo Ying Ru, WHO representative to Malaysia, Brunei Darussalam and Singapore, about how serious this problem is.
Well, antibiotic resistance is a very serious threat to global public health all over the world, including in Malaysia, as was just mentioned. So high levels of antibiotic resistance have been described everywhere. The best data are most of the data are available from Western Europe and the United States. But increasingly also we see data from Malaysia, which suggests that antibiotic resistance is increasing. Having said that, I just wanted to say that antibiotic resistance is naturally occurring. It happens when bacteria change or become resistant as they are exposed to antibiotics in this case. And that means medicines we use to treat bacterial infections, they become ineffective. And overuse or misuse, that means, for example, you use it when it's not necessary or you don't use it correctly in both in humans, but also in animals, is contributing to rising threat of antibiotic resistance.
Now, moving on to the next item on the list, crises such as drought, famine, conflict and population displacement, as well as poor health services, have left 1.6 billion people around the world, that's almost a quarter of the planet's population, without access to basic care.
Also on the list, I think we know this one quite well, dengue. The mosquito-borne disease has plagued our country for decades and many other tropical countries as well, especially during the rainy season. Now, these seasons are lengthening significantly, and the disease is spreading to less tropical and more temperate countries as well, perhaps thanks to climate change and as well as the evolution of the virus and its vector.
Yes, and speaking of climate change, the WHO actually considers air pollution as a major contributor to climate change, causing 9 out of 10 people to breathe polluted air every day. So climate change is also expected to cause 250,000 additional deaths per year from things like malnutrition, malaria, diarrhea, and heat stress between 2030 and 2050. That's not very far away. Mm-hmm. And the WHO also says that air pollution is the greatest environmental risk risk to health this year, killing 7 million people prematurely from diseases. I mean, so what exactly are these diseases? Here's a short clip from a past interview with Dr. Jessie Andebruin. She's a consultant pediatrician and respiratory physician.
Well, obviously, if it's the air that we breathe, diseases of the lungs would be one of the more important things. So like chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, lung cancers, also diseases related to the cardiovascular system, increased risk of heart attacks, of strokes, ischemic heart disease. These are the main things. But air pollution has also been linked to neurodegenerative diseases in older people and neurodevelopmental problems in babies.
Oh, so do you remember, Tina, last year we did a Health News Digest on the Ebola comeback? Yeah. So, you know, turns out it's not the end of Ebola just yet. According to the WHO, we need to be prepared for high-threat pathogens, so like Ebola, but also others like Zika. Remember when that swept through Brazil? It was really horrifying. MERS, which is the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus, and Disease X, which is just about the most horrifying name you could give to something.
Yeah, but basically it represents any unknown pathogens.
Yeah, so we know that we need to be prepared for the next serious epidemic. We just don't know what it will be yet.
Yeah. It's true, it's terrifying. But, you know, when an epidemic does spread throughout the world, it's known as a pandemic, and the world will face another influenza pandemic. So every year, WHO recommends which strains should be included in the flu vaccine to protect people from the seasonal flu. And in the event that a new flu strain develops pandemic potential, WHO has set up a partnership with the major players to ensure effective and equitable access to diagnostics, vaccines, and antivirals, so treatments basically, especially in developing countries.
But, you know, isn't the flu just part and parcel of life? We've all had it before and we're all still here. Well, most of us are. So what's the big deal? Here's consultant pediatrician Dr. Zulkifli Ismail explaining why at the recent Health and Living Junior event.
Now, if you notice, we never mentioned about flu before, right? We did not tell people to get the flu vaccine. But we are telling them to get it now because of this outbreak, because of travel. Right? In the past, we never thought that, you know, it's always a problem with the United States in winter. It's a problem with UK in the winter. It's a problem with Australia in winter. We don't have winters. So, and then when we looked at the data, we see that we actually have flu outbreaks. And then everybody's traveling everywhere and bringing back the virus. So now we tell our parents and patients that we actually recommend it, because right now in the ward where I just finished work just now, there are 3 patients with influenza, right? 2 of them influenza A, 1 with influenza B, 1 with severe pneumonia. So it's with us. So if you ask me, should we get it or not? Yes, you should get it if money is not a problem, because the vaccine will have to be given on a yearly basis. And by the way, for us, as healthcare workers, I've been giving myself the flu vaccine for the last decade or so because we are at high risk. So if you see me living up to this age, shouldn't be a problem, right?
Dr. Zhou. But, you know, primary healthcare is usually the first point of contact people have with the healthcare system and ideally should provide comprehensive, affordable, community-based care throughout life. Yet so many communities still lack access to adequate primary healthcare services.
And the final item on the list, so this harks back to, you know, Dr. Zhou talking about vaccines and our poll question as well. Vaccine hesitancy as a global health threat. Now, that's a new way to put it, actually. I've heard about refusal, I've not heard about hesitancy. Yeah. So the WHO recognizes that the rise in the reluctance or refusal to vaccinate, despite the availability of vaccines, threatens to reverse progress made in tackling vaccine-preventable diseases. Now, the reasons not to vaccinate, of course, are complex, and we've covered that extensively on our Health and Living segment. One of the most compelling arguments against the anti-vaccine movement was made by consultant pediatrician Dr. Musa Muhammad Nordin.
I would like to paint the bigger picture first, all right? One, especially for your Muslim listeners, yeah? There's a verse in the Quran that says, وَمَنْ أَحْيَا فَكَإِنَّمْ أَحْيَا النَّاسَ جَمِيعًا. If you save one life, it is though you save the whole of humanity. That's from the Quran. And secondly, there is a benchmark in Islam which says, الْوِقَايَةُ خَيْرٌ مِنَ الْإِلَاجِ. Prevention is better than cure. You know this much well. An ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. So these are the values that I hope the Muslim listeners would treasure. Yeah? And that is, and as far as vaccination is concerned, at this point in time, as I'm speaking, we are saving 2.5 million lives every year. Right? And there is an opportunity if we use better the available vaccine, or if we use the newer vaccines like rotavirus and pneumococcal, an opportunity to save another 1.5 million lives. And as I'm speaking, we are preventing 750,000 disabilities a year. Mm. So this, my personal fatwa goes beyond darurat.
Oh, personal fatwa.
It goes beyond. It's saying that it's not just darurat. Yeah, yeah. It is doing a service to humanity. Mm. And this is not my first fatwa. It actually comes from the fatwa of the European Council for Research and Fatwa. So, which is headed by the topmost cleric in the world, which is Sheikh Yusuf Al-Qardawi. And I think the Muslims will know this. So I hope I reassure the listeners, the one who hesitant, that vaccination is probably the top most public health intervention, just second to
water.
Clean water.
And that's the list, folks. Agree, disagree, you can let us know your thoughts.
Well, you know, I definitely agree that vaccine refusal is something we really have to contend with as
vaccine hesitancy,
Sorry. Yeah, so getting back to that, that's very interesting, a new way of putting it. Well, it's new to me anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
But it does encompass the hardcore anti-vaxxers who flat out refuse, and those who perhaps just need a bit of coaxing, mm-hmm. I think, and those who are hesitant because of, you know, they may be concerned about halal vaccines, for instance, or some myths and misconceptions that they've heard. But I remember on this show with Dr. Musa as well, he did mention that we don't have so many of the hardcore anti-vaxxers in Malaysia. It's the ones who are hesitant. And with a bit of education, a bit of talking to them, they're actually open to the idea.
And I think maybe cost is something else that you know, prohibits people. I know some. I remember reading some articles where, you know, a child actually died from, I think it was diphtheria, because the parents couldn't afford to get the vaccination.
Well, the thing is, in our country, diphtheria, the vaccine for that, the DTP, is provided for free under the National Immunization Program in government clinics.
Yeah. So you have to go to the Klinik Kesehatan or the government hospitals.
Okay, so perhaps maybe it wasn't cost then, perhaps it was access, because I think these were very, very very poor people who, you know, didn't have actual lodging. You know, they were. They, you know,
so it's perhaps that taking the time off from work to mm-hmm. then to travel to the clinic and then wait. I mean, it's all of that. Those are costs too. It's not just monetary. Yeah,
even the knowledge of these diseases, you know, existing, and you know, the knowledge that, you know, these are some things that we have to get done. You know, I'm sure they, you know, like when we give birth in private hospitals, for example, they lay it out for you at the start. I don't know about government hospitals. I'm sure they do the same thing
actually,
as well, right?
I would think that if you are in a government hospital system, if you start off going for your maternal health checkups, mm-hmm. A lot of them follow through and they are kept within the system very well. And because there's I would say perhaps low-income and rural communities, there's a huge trust actually in the healthcare mm-hmm, system mm-hmm. because they are getting these services for free. So there's a very good follow-up system, especially for immunizations and checkups.
And correct me if I'm wrong, you know, if you don't follow up with that, you can't actually enroll in government schools, because you have to have that the list. You know, you have to show mm-hmm. that you did your work line, you got all those vaccines for your children.
Well, really?
That was what was told to me. I mean, and that was in a private hospital, so they told me I needed to keep my daughter's vaccination record because I needed to present it when my child entered school. At the age of seven.
That's a much tighter form of regulation than I think what we know of.
Because we have talked about how is it Australia that does
no jab, no play.
No play.
Yeah, so they can't enroll even in kindergarten at this stage. Yeah, but we don't really have that sort of. Well, I don't think it's strictly regulated. Maybe I'm probably what's probably the case here.
Maybe it's just to let the schools know what you've got and what you haven't got. So,
well, in my son's kindergarten, they've just recently asked for a list of his immunizations because the state health department will make checks.
Oh, there you go.
So perhaps there's a lot of some self-regulation going on as well.
Oh, that's very, very good then. Mm-hmm. Because we do, I mean, if the WHO considers vaccine hesitancy one of its top 10 global health threat, then I think at least we're doing something to address that. We're at least a few steps ahead. Yeah. I mean, is there anything that's surprising for you guys that's on the list, or maybe something you'd like to add to the list? Even.
Well, I guess what was surprising was, of course, influenza, because we don't take the cold seriously. We don't take influenza seriously over here as they do perhaps in places like England and in the US, you know, where I always read, it shocks me then when I read news articles about people dying from the flu. You know,
huge numbers,
right? Because I guess it's also got to do with the weather and, you know, temperature and all of that. So that was actually shocking to me that, and you know, like Dr. Zul said, you know, there's, when I go to the hospital for checkups, my doctor has warned me, you know, there's an influenza outbreak, you really need to be careful, you know, maybe you should consider getting the jab and things like that. It's, yeah, that was shocking to me.
Yeah, and I think that that increases the skepticism towards vaccination, because for all of us who have, I mean, we've all had the flu at some point in our lives, right? And probably many times as well. And we've all survived it. So if the doctors are now not forcing us, so telling us to get the flu
vaccine,
when, you know, for the past 10, 20, 30 years, we didn't ever need it, then this must be another money-making pyramid scheme that they're on to.
Conspiracy by the companies.
Yeah. Not realizing that the flu virus has gotten so much more virulent and more deadly in the past couple of decades. And that's the reason why this became a lot more important now than it was in the past.
Well, a lot of what we thought was the flu was probably just the common cold, which is not caused by influenza. And you have different strains of influenza. Now, look, I've gotten influenza A before and it was terrible.
Yeah.
So definitely, if you can afford the vaccine, especially for the very young children and the elderly, that's who will be most vulnerable to the complications.
I think the naming convention, the terminology also plays a role, right? When you say the flu, it's like, oh, it's nothing. Yeah,
it's just the flu.
Yeah, it's just the flu, right? Yeah. But when you say SARS, which is also a form of influenza, or H1N1, it becomes so scary. Yeah. But those are also different influenza strains, and they're the deadly strains. So. Yeah. So there you go. I think that's all the time we have left. But before that, a last check on the Twitter poll, shall we?
Yep. So most of you still feel that anti-vaxxers cause more diseases and that they will be dangerous. They pose a threat to our health in the population. Very few of you agree with anti-vaxxers. So keep it up. Keep our children safe and healthy, right?
But that's only a 90% herd community coverage. So,
so we need, what, 95%,
yes,
right?
So still a bit more work to do. All right, so that's all the time we have today. All the clips that you've heard came from various interviews we've done the past year, which you can look up on our site or on our BFM app. If you missed any part of this show, you can also find the podcast later this afternoon. If jazz is your thing, keep tuning in, because on Front Row at 3 p.m., Sharmila Ganesan brings you the 6th Malaysian Jazz Piano Festival. To take you there, here's Fever by Michael Bublé, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.